Welcome to our JCC Coffee Cake and Learning, Parshas Korach, the Road to Hell. So our Parsha begins with a man named Korach, the hero or the anti-hero, or I would say the tragic villain of the piece. So let us look at source one. This is the first verse of our Parsha. It says, Korach, the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kahat, that means his grandfather, the son of Levi, his great-great-grandfather, took, and then it says in parentheses, himself to one side, but it doesn't actually say that in the text. It just says he took. He took along with, I'm sorry for the typo here, I didn't have my editor-in-chief, Datan and Avira. Remember Datan and Avira? Where's your God now, Moses? Remember Edward G. Robinson, of course, right? I heard Billy Crystal doing a very funny, like, these people should never be in a biblical movie. And he talked about Edward G. Robinson, you know? Where is your God now, Moses? You know, that was him. Datan and Aviram, who were the sons of Eliab, and On, that was his name, the son of Pelet, who were all descendants of Reuven. So what is missing here? What's missing here is, I'll read it without the parentheses. Ready? Korach, the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kahat, the son of Levi, took, comma, along with Datan Aviram, the sons of Eliab and On. Well, what did he take? There's no object. Yeah? There's missing an object. So Rashi says, Korach took, third line, bold print. He took himself, he's the object, to one side to disassociate himself from the congregation, to contest the appointment of his of Aaron, big brother of Moses, to the kahuna, to the priesthood. He, Korach, separated himself from the congregation to persist in a machloket, a dispute, an argument. Ooh. Now, it's strange that we have to sort of extrapolate from this missing object what was going on. But on the other hand, this is the key to our parsha. The road to hell is simply a dispute that is for illegitimate, nefarious purposes. Now, this has been the plague, or one of the major plagues of our people forever. It's such an issue that we all have the jokes, right? The Jew, Robinson Crusoe guy on the desert island, and he's there for a few years. We'll call him Chaim, right? And they rescue him. And Chaim's giving the people the tour of the island. And he's built up of infrastructure because he's a builder. He's a real estate guy. And he takes them around his living. He has a beautiful condo, you know, satellite TV and Wi-Fi. Okay, it's like Gilligan's Island. By the way, remember Gilligan's Island? I love the way the Howells, even, did you know, they didn't have any money. But their station in life was identical as if they had the money, right? I loved it. Love it. So they're on Gilligan's Island, sort of. And he's giving them the tour. And he takes them to this beautiful little synagogue. Like, it's like the size of our room here, the Rifkin, and it's immaculate, it's beautiful. And they leave the synagogue, and they notice another equally immaculate building just down the block. So they look at him, they say, well, what is that building down there? Well, that's the other synagogue. The other synagogue? But you're here by yourself, Robinson Crusoe, Chaim. Why would you need two synagogues? What do you mean? This is the shul, the synagogue I always pray at. I never set foot in that one. Right? So we soft pedal this potentially destructive force of dispute, of machlokas, because it's almost like ingrained in the nature of who and what we are. And it's problematic, to say the least. So Korach is so paradigmatic of this issue that look at source number two. There's an incredible tractate called Avot, the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, Chapters of Our Fathers. And it is oral Torah. There are 63 books of the oral tradition. One of them and one of them only, Avot, is unique in that it's not a halachic work. It doesn't teach you Jewish law like the rest. Nope. It's sort of like it's a little mussar, it's a little bit of how to live life, morals, ethics, guidance, the best of the best of the rabbis to teach us how to behave and be better people. So listen to what it says in Ethics of Our Fathers 5:17. Any dispute which is for the sake of heaven, will endure and bring life. Any dispute which is not for the sake of heaven will not endure and leads to death. Okay, well, what defines a dispute for the sake of heaven? The dispute of Hillel and Shammai, the great sages of our Talmud. What defines a dispute not for the sake of heaven? The dispute involving Korach and his company, Korach Va'adato. So there are two issues with this Pirkei Avot that I'm going to bring up. They're not issues in the end. I'm not, like, God forbid, condemning the rabbis who wrote this are magnificent. But they wrote it in a way that doesn't lend itself to immediate comprehension. And if the intention of this Mishnah is to help us with our lives, then it's not very helpful. Okay, so let's point out two little oddities. Ready? Any dispute which for the sake of heaven will endure and bring life, any blah, blah, blah. And then it says, well, how do you know if you're involved in a dispute that's for the sake of heaven? Well, you're like Hillel and Shammai. You're arguing in Torah. Maybe. Okay. And how do you know it's a dispute that's, you should get out of it, extricate yourself? It's not for the sake of heaven. That's our parsha, Korach and his dispute, his company. But wait a minute. But the dispute of Korach was not between him and his cohorts. It wasn't him and Edward G. Robinson et al. His dispute was with Moses and Aaron. He disputed them being the leaders of the Jewish people. So what should the structure, if you want to keep like this parallel bent in the Mishnah, should say, Hillel Shammai would argue, good. Korach, Moses, and Aaron, bad. But it says Korach and his company. It almost implies that his dispute was not with Moses and Aaron, it's almost like it's between Korach and the Edward G. Robinson guy, Datan and Aviram and his other cohorts. That's weird, right? That's strange. Second problem, let's pretend I'm in a heated debate in the moment, right? And I want to reach out to this Torah for guidance. Should I stop the debate and say, time out, it's getting heated. This is not leading us to a productive end. We're going to be like Korach. Let's just stop it now and let's make up. We love each other. We'll walk away. Or can I continue? Because I could say, oh, wait a minute. It's great. We're being argumentative. Yeah. But we're emulating the great rabbis, Hillel and Shammai. Of course, let's continue the debate. How do I know to disengage or to engage? Yeah. If you tell me that it endures and has long life, well, that doesn't help me in the moment of the heat. That doesn't help me at all, does it? So we need to sort of unpackage how to understand this Mishnah. And at the end of the day, hopefully it will give us some real tactile approaches, okay? So first, let's unpackage the first issue, the lack of parallel structure, right? We pointed out that Hillel and Shammai were two great rabbis who debated 316 times in the Talmud. 316 times they debated, okay? That is good. Korach and his cohorts, well, why does it say and his cohorts when it should have said Moses and Aaron? So what happened with Korach? Korach was passed over for promotion. He was okay with Moses and Aaron kind of being who they were, but when a younger first cousin of his was given sort of tribal leadership, he got bent out of shape and he thought to himself, well, this is not right. How come, what about me? Am I chopped liver? Why are you passing me over? So he was aggrieved. So he knew that he had to wait for the moment of opportunity. So earlier on in the stories, it was not an opportune moment. Can you imagine, like if he got up at Mount Sinai, when Moses' Rasmussen poll numbers were at 100% and started to try to pretend that Moses and Aaron didn't deserve who they were given their positions in life, the people would have just not heard him, not listened. So he waited for his moment. And if you look at last week and the week before, what happened? You had the spies. The spies caused the deaths of the generation between age 20 and 60. The male population, they would wander around in that desert for 40 years, so they all died, and only the next generation would go. So there was a lot of misery, discontent, and outright anger amongst certain segments of the Jewish people. So Korach started to foment rebellion, insurrection. And he did it in a very sneaky way. He went to his neighbors. The tribe of Reuven and the tribe of the Levites, where they were like next door. And so he would start to talk to Datan and Aviram, who we know historically, ever since Egypt, always had it in for Moses. Yeah, they always did, from beginning to end. Nefarious characters of the highest order. And he brought in Reuven. Now, why were Reuven an easy target? Because, you see, they were the firstborn of the Jewish people. They originally, in God's vision, were supposed to be the priests, the Kohanim. But it was stripped from them. Why? Because Reuven did a sin. Well, I don't have to go in there, but Reuven did something wrong. And because of Reuven's sin, they were sort of relegated, and the status of serving God in the unique way was given to Levi, the tribe, and specifically to Aaron and his children to serve as priests. No one else is allowed to serve as a priest or as a Levite unless you have your lineage, your yichus, as they say in Yiddish, has to come from Levi and the kahuna, the priesthood from Aaron. Okay, so they're a really good potential target because they have a grievance. Because this is all about, well, who are the leadership? Reuven originally, they're supposed to be the leaders along with Judah, the kings of Israel. But they were stripped of that, so they're targets of influence. And he starts to sort of ingratiate himself in. And what does Korach do? He packages himself as a man of the people. And he comes to Moses, and he has Datan, Aviram, and all the rest of his cohorts. And Moses and Aaron are there. And he engages him in a debate. The only problem is, it's not really a debate, as you'll hear. So he asks, he says, Moshe Rabbeinu Moses, the great one himself, I have a question. I have a halachic Jewish question of Torah. Moshe said, yes, Korach, tell me, what's your question? He said, well, if I had a house and I filled the house from top to bottom with kosher Torah scrolls, would that house still need a mezuzah on the doorpost? Moses said, yeah. Ah, he said, you're an idiot. But he didn't say it quite like that. He said it to his men. He said, this is a joke. Why is it a joke? If a mezuzah exempts an entire house from having to worry about Torah scrolls, and it only has like the Shema, one little segment of the Torah in it, written in small parchment. So you have an entire Torah that has the mezuzah times 1,000 pieces, and you have 100 and 100 and 100s of Torah scrolls, top to bottom. Why would you need a mezuzah? So he thought that was ridiculous. And he asked the question, same about the tzitzis, the four-cornered garments, that what if you had a garment that was all purple? It all had tekelet, this beautiful little dye. We're supposed to have one little fringe, one of the tzitziot. The fringes are supposed to have that tekelet in it. He said, what if you had an entire garment made of the purple dye? Would you still need to have the fringes, the tzitzis on it? He said, yeah. Ah, again, this is ridiculous. The whole garment is made out of pure tekelet. It's dyed 100%. Why would you need tzitzis if one little strand exempts the whole garment? Like the mezuzah would be exempted, you know, from the house. That little. So what is he saying with this? Well, he walked away, mocking Moses and Aaron, ascribing the law to the invention of Moses and Aaron and not God's Torah law. Meaning, well, if he could make up that ridiculous ruling by a mezuzah and the tzitzis, then what about the appointments of himself as the de facto king of the Jews and his big brother Aaron as the Kohen? Maybe he also is influenced by bias, nepotism, yeah? So that was the whole Korach issue. There's only one problem. Korach is a sneaky guy. He knew that if he would wait and debate with Moses, go back and forth with him in a dialogue, what would Moses do to his thought process? He would blow it up. Moses was brilliant. So Moses would undermine Korach's man of the people, I'm making it up. No, Moses would explain to him in great detail, yes, it's a great question, it's a valid question, and here's why you are wrong. But instead, he disengaged himself after asking the question. And as they're walking away, he's cynically, snidely making little remarks to the people about how Moses and Aaron, it's all about nepotism, yeah? So he never really had a debate. So our Mishnah can't say, oh, well, Hillel and Shammai argued, and so did, as we thought it should say, Korach and Moses. You know why? Because there was never a debate. He refused to debate directly with Moses. He did it in an underhanded, backward way. Okay, that helps us with one part of the issue, right? Why it doesn't say Moses' name. But it doesn't help us to understand, well, what is the debate between Korach and his company, right? His minions. What is that all about? Why would it use that word? You see, Korach, and I'm just, for expedience sake, I'm not going to go through here. I'm just going to tell it to you outside, okay? But it's all in here. You can take it home and review if you wish. So here's the bottom line. Korach entered into the debate because he thought at the end of the day, he wins. He has inside information. He's like the guy going to the racetrack. And the jockey has told him that Secretariat has a little bit of a nail issue. A nail got onto the hoof today before the Belmont. And he's putting big money on Man of War that day to upset Secretariat because he has the inside jockey information. He had a prophetic vision, did Korach. And in his vision, he saw that the great prophet Samuel, Shmuel HaNavi, would descend from his loins. It would be a great-great-grandson of his. So Korach misunderstood the vision because he thought, well, wait a minute. If Samuel is my great-great-grandson and he is compared to both Moses and Aaron in his accomplishments and his greatness, his grandeur, then that means that whatever else happens, I live another day. But there's a small problem here. He didn't tell his cohorts that he had this inside information. So when he challenges Moses and Aaron's authority, and Moses throws down the gambit, he says, okay, Korach, this is what we're going to do. We're going to offer incense, you, Aaron, and any of your men, 250, who want to come in. But know this, if you take the incense offering, and you burn it, and you bring it into the tabernacle before God, there's only one legitimate person who's allowed to do this. And everyone else is going to lose their life. Now, there's something called Russian roulette, yeah? So you get a revolver. You have six chambers. You put in one bullet. You spin the bullet around in the chambers and you say, good luck, you know? So that's a 1 in 6, yeah? Okay. But this is beyond Meshuggah. Think about it. So Moses says to him, Korach, there's 250 chambers in this very large, dirty, hairy 44 Magnum. And I'm going to have 250 chambers. The only difference is we're playing inverted Russian roulette. It's called Dirty Harry Russian roulette. And there's only going to be one chamber empty, and 249 44 Magnum bullets are going to occupy the other chambers. What? What insane human being would take that upon themselves? Well, now we know why Korach did it, because he thought, Samuel's coming for me. I'm going to get the lucky empty chamber. Now, he didn't, of course. But let me ask you a question. He had his company, right? The Reuven people, the people who were like Datan and Aviram. They're on the periphery of the Machaneh, the camp of the Jewish people, and they have their own little grievances and agendas, and they're all part of him. If you're a decent human being, which Korach clearly wasn't, I think I dare say I would go to my 250 and I'd say, look, guys, I love you, but I want you to know, let me challenge Aaron alone. Don't offer the incense because you're dead. I'm not dead because I have Samuel from me. I have inside information that I walk away. You're going to sacrifice. But he didn't say anything. What did he do? He just threw them under the bus. Yeah, take the incense, come in and die and be immolated. Beautiful, what a nice guy. So therefore, our Mishnah, by saying that the dispute is between Korach and his minions, it's showing us the lack of unity and purpose that Korach had with even his own pals, that he just threw them under the bus and killed them, not even giving them a fair warning to desist, and don't do this. Don't pursue this, right? So that's now the reason why the structure is a structure, right? So we have clarity on that. That is why that Hillel and Shammai are actually debating. No mention of Moses debating with Korach, as we said, because there was no dialogue. Korach refused to have a dialogue. And secondarily, why does it mention his company as if that's a debate? Because it was a debate. From the point of view of Korach, he was willing to sacrifice his 250 friends for the cause. What's 250 friends between pals, yeah? Didn't even give them a heads up. Okay. What's our second question? If this Mishnah is meant to teach us the difference, to help us understand that if I'm engaged in an argument now, right this moment, is it a Hillel and Shammai kosher debate, or is it a Korach road to hell debate? So how do I know if I have to wait for, like, I don't know, 6 months, a year, 5 years? That's not helpful in the moment, yeah? So, by the way, you mentioned about hell. So have a look at source number 5. So just as a sidelight, just to show you where the word comes from. So on the second day of creation, God divided, separated between the waters that were everywhere in the world and separated the waters to go up and waters to go down as an act of creation. It shall divide between waters and waters. Here is where dispute arose. And from dispute came the fire of animosity. And from dispute came hell itself. Such was the dispute of Korach, not for the sake of heaven, but dispute that becomes refined as above. Dispute which reaches ever higher and higher, enduring along a wholesome path. Such was the dispute of Shammai and Hillel. And God divided between them and acknowledge them both. This is the dispute for heaven. So stop for one moment. So how do I know that? Lacking foresight about whether our debate is going to be a wholly enduring debate, how do I know whether to extricate myself in the moment? How do I know? It's very simple. Hillel and Shammai had 316 disputes, yeah? But they loved each other. It's not just that they loved each other. If you would go to Rabbi Hillel, the elder himself, and you would say, Rabbi, that's how they used to talk in Memphis. Rabbi, is that kosher product kosher enough? Right? I'm talking too fast. They would speak much slower, but we don't have time. That's how they asked the questions to Rabbi Greenblatt, my posek in Memphis, I'm sure. Rabbi. So if you go to the rabbi and you ask that question, you go, Rabbi Hillel, is this kosher or not? He would ask the following question. Tell me, my friend, did you ask the same question yet to my colleague, Rabbi Shammai? You say, yeah, I went to Rabbi Shammai. Okay, please tell me, what did he tell you is the ruling? What ruling did he give you? Oh, he said it was kosher. Really? Did he explain to you the ruling? What it's based on? Which verses and the logic? Yeah, could you share that with me, please? Yeah, he said it's based on this and this. Yeah. Okay, beautiful. Now I'll give you my ruling. And he would give you his ruling. Either agreed, disagreed, and now he has. That is the magic of a dispute. It's not just that I allow you and you allow me room for discourse. Yeah? It's not that. It's more than that. Shammai and Hillel, and Hillel and Shammai were so magnificent that one could not be the other without the other. So in other words, Hillel is basically saying, I can't offer you an opinion unless I understand Shammai's opinion in this, because I can't refine my decision-making without hearing his learning and his thought process. Then and only then can I refine and define what the rule is. It's not just I'm being a nice guy and said, oh, one of the other rabbis say. No. I, Hillel, can't be Hillel unless there's a Shammai ruling also. That is a dispute for the sake of heaven. Because if I ascribe gravitas, import, but more than that, a need to understand So somebody is debating about Israel, about this, right or wrong. I need to understand the other position before I even can have my own position. If that is the attitude, if that's the approach, then that is glorious. That is magnificent. Because that's not a destructive dispute. That is a dispute that is engaging us both. And at the end of the day, when we walk away, we're both going to be elevated in our understanding. And even if we don't agree at the end of the day, right? Even if you hold your position, I hold my position, I really do understand your position, why you are a contrarian, why you are not an Edmonton Oilers hockey fan, why you're a Toronto Maple Leaf hockey fan. At the end of the day, you've given me the background, and yes, I'm not going to root for the Leafs. At the end of the day, I'm still an Oilers fan, but now thanks to your learning and your understanding, your explanation and your sources, I now have a better grasp on who I am and why I am who I am. This was all Shammai and Hillel, Hillel and Shammai. Not only that, but when you went to Hillel, he would first quote the ruling to you. So let's say you didn't go to Shammai. So he would say to you, oh, by the way, before I rule, I just want you to know that my friend Shammai, this is his thought process. He would quote Shammai and then say, and this is what I believe. Wow, that is magnificence. In our world today, suffice it to say, that we Jews still are plagued by dispute. And yet at the end of the day, they both could be true. We discussed this in a different way, but I'll just bring it back because I think it's very profound. We discussed Niels Bohr. Do you remember we discussed the Danish physicist who's the master of quantum physics? If you weren't here for the class or you don't remember, it's okay. So Niels Bohr came up with an incredible concept. Does light, is it a wave or a particle? It cannot be both. It's impossible. And he discovered that actually, depending on how you measure it, it actually could either be a particle or it can behave like a wave. And it's a duality. And he created this duality, which applies obviously in physics. Now remember, this is nature. Because what was the first act of creation of God? Let there be light. Light is the essence of nature and of our world. That there is a duality. And it's true that light can behave as a particle, and it's equally true that life can behave as a wave. They're both equal true expressions of light. So Shammai and Hillel, their expressions of Torah can seemingly be opposite, and yet they're complementary. There's a duality that comes together. And so within the confines of our discussion, both can be true. So I'll illustrate this in a very powerful, profound way. So you know that Israel, even with all the wars and with all its sorrows, there's still a break in Israel. There are those who believe that the war in Gaza must end today, and we must at any cost bring home the bodies of our hostages and any living hostage. And there's absolute emet to that. I mean, what could be truer? I can't even imagine. I can't fathom the pain of a mother, father, brother, spouse, not knowing, alive or dead, or even the imagination that would run to the pit of Gehenna, of hell itself, of what my loved one's going through potentially right now, almost 600 whatever days of captivity. It's unthinkable. So that is absolutely true, that we at all costs need to bring them home. It's true. That's a wave. But there's also a particle that we can never allow October 7th to come back. And we must finish Hamas, whatever that would mean. I'm not smart enough to know that. But the war and the pursuit of the end of Hamas is equally a valid position. So both, even though they're similarly at loggerheads, because one can't really be achieved without the other one, there's no way to really achieve both simultaneously, but they're both equal truths. And if we, and especially our brothers and sisters in Israel, could somehow get into the Shammai Hillel thing, that it's okay to be blessing both, so you can at the same time be aggrieved at the loss of our hostages and the fact that they're still in captivity, and at the same time realize there's a necessity to pursue this war until whatever that would mean at the end of Hamas. But they both can be two equally true components, Shammai Hillel, Hillel Shammai, wave, particle, particle, wave. And if this was the Israeli approach, And instead of killing each other, instead of the protests and the undermining each other, which they are still doing, unfortunately, tragically in Israel, it is just hurting us and killing us. It's doing the korach to us. And instead, if we could just ascribe, I love you, and I wish I could just hug your child and bring them home tomorrow. But we can't do that at any cost. And the opposite, I want my child home, but I also understand that there's another side of the necessity to eradicate Hamas. And both can be absolutely equal truths in this world that coexist in this world. And again, I'm not saying that's a solution, but at least it's the beginning of a rapprochement and a healing that we so desperately need. And we can, of course, apply that to so many other areas of life, both here and there. So may it be with God's will that we emulate the great Hillel and Shammai, Shammai Hillel, and realize that, yes, we're all individuals, but at the end of the day, if we will just give the other person, not just we're humoring them and waiting to get my next barb in the debate, because, you know, I do that also. You're like waiting. You're not even paying attention to what they're saying. You're just waiting them to shut up for a moment so that you can interject, right? That's not a debate. That's Shammai Hillel. A Shammai Hillel debate is silence. I'm hearing you. I'm listening to your position. I want to take it in. I want to understand. And if I'm asking questions, they're thoughtful questions to probe and for you to explain and flesh out your position. And then and only then I offer my position after having heard. And I might say to you, you know, yeah, you make a great point. Oh my gosh, I didn't think of it that way. I didn't base my source on that. What do you think about that? If that is the level of discourse between us, I 100% believe that the geula, the redemption, will be in our days. B'mehera, b'yameinu. Thank you, everyone.